But the Adams here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military Adam, like who gets there firstest with the mostest Adams. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They gotta get together or disintegrate. A whole less truth to be self-evident that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Steinbrenner, who's a professor of public policy at the University of Maryland, where he directs the Center for International and Security Studies. He has authored and edited a number of books, including The Cybernetic Theory of Decision, New Dimensions of Political Analysis, Principles of Global Security, and A New Concept of Cooperative Security. He co-chairs the Committee on International Security Studies of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and is chairman of the board of the Armed Control Association. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Steinbrenner.
Thank you very much.
And it seems that the summit in South Korea, leaders of 54 nations are gathering ostensibly to talk about nuclear security and getting more than 50 nations to secure or give up their nuclear material, but it's been largely overshadowed by North Korea. North Korea has a peculiar ability of, in spite of its impoverished, pathetic state of affairs, it manages to capture headlines, and in this case, it seems to be upstaging the entire world.
It certainly does seem to have dominated the news coming out of the summit. Unless you're there, it's hard to tell how much it's actually dominated the summit discussion, but it certainly has dominated the news reporting about it.
And in terms of arms control, at least in the traditional sense, the old Cold War sense, is there much that's come out of the meetings with President Obama and Medvedev? Because he's leaving power, Putin's coming in. Much of, again, the press focus has been on the off-the-cuff remarks that were picked up on the microphones where, Obama's asking Medvedev for a little space so that once he gets reelected, he'll have more flexibility. And Medvedev says, yeah, I'll pass that on to Vladimir. No big headlines, but obviously, again, capturing people's attention. Any substance to the discussions that you know of?
As far as I can tell from the coverage, there hasn't been anything that would qualify as major substance. They're rehearsing well-known themes. Obama did suggest that he's interested in further reducing the number of nuclear weapons under the START agreement, but he didn't specify a number, and it's unlikely that he will specify a number, actually, until after the election. He would, not unreasonably want to keep that out of electoral politics. And actually, the North Koreans, intentionally or otherwise, are reminding us that in a very uncomfortable way, is that there are issues of equity here that are, you could say, the major powers, the United States included, are having difficulty addressing. And nobody, of course, the North Koreans are demonized in most part of the world, and almost nobody is willing to defend their perspective given the way they present it, but they are raising an issue about why is it that they should not be allowed to launch a satellite and everybody else should be. The answer is a UN Security Council resolution back in 2006 that in reaction to their nuclear weapons test said that they were not supposed to launch missiles or conduct further tests, and imposed, if you will, the authority of the UN Security Council to make that illegal. And given that, and given that North Korea did agree apparently not to conduct a test in response for food aid just very recently, they put Obama in a very awkward situation where he sort of has to defend, if you will, the diplomacy and insist that they not conduct a test, but it puts him in a position of defending an egregious inequity from almost everybody's point of view. And he's been put in a very awkward situation.
Isn't it likely, though, that this is also, I mean, not likely, this is a pattern of North Korean negotiating. They make an agreement and then they immediately go ahead with a deal breaker. which is what they're doing now. And once they do the test, in spite of efforts to get the Chinese to dissuade them, it's likely that they'll go ahead with the test, the missile test, and then perhaps another nuclear test, and then come back to the negotiating table from a position of greater strength.
It wouldn't be a position of greater strength. I mean, it is said that that is the case, but I think in reality it is not the case. They are violating, egregiously violating international norms here because of the resolution, and they will not come back in greater strength. This is not something that you would do to gain bargaining leverage internationally. It's something you might do if you have political difficulty within your own country. And that's the better interpretation of what's going on here. It is the case that in many instances of this in the past where they seem to be breaking an agreement arbitrarily, there are hidden details where they've been provoked by details of the negotiation on our side, which somehow never really get out. I don't know that that's... I myself cannot identify such a thing in this case. It doesn't look like it would be. We've been negotiating for delivery of food aid in exchange for their not agreeing to testing, and I am unaware of any glitch in that process that might have provoked the North Koreans. But that kind of thing has happened in the past.
Just in terms of arms control, again, between the haves as opposed to the have-nots or the want-to-have-mores, the president did declare, he was actually quite passionate at times, he said flatly that the United States has more nuclear weapons than it needs and it can cut its arsenal without weakening its security or that of its allies. But then he sort of got very personal and spoke of his wish for further reductions, and as the president of the only nation to have set off a nuclear weapon in anger, he also said, as a commander of a country whose nuclear codes, the football, is never far from his side, he spoke also as a protective father, wanting to erase this threat of annihilation for future generations. How's that likely to be accepted, do you think?
Oh, those are very welcome words to everyone. And I think most of the world is willing to believe that he personally means it. And that is, to put it mildly, different from most of his predecessors, actually. And he's credited for that, and that probably is a good part of the reason why he was awarded the Nobel Prize based upon speeches, basically. The question is, does he have the ability, if you will, to really impose restraining outcomes? And to put it mildly, everybody looking from the outside of the American political process has a question of that sort in their mind. He's committed, but can he bring the United States along? And that is a question.
And that, of course, was one part of his comment to the outgoing Russian president.
Right.
You know, wait till after the elections.
Right. Don't push me at this moment, right? This is not something I wish to run on beyond what he's already said. I mean, he's made his... But any time he specifies any detail, he will be attacked from right-wing sources, belligerent nationalist sources, and everybody knows that. And the question is, can he really bring about meaningful restraint on the largest and most capable arsenal? I think he does get credit. He should get credit for personally wanting to do it, being quite serious about it. But his whole presidency is a question of whether he can deliver. Can he make the machinery work? And that is a question in this case.
Well, he went on to say that they're continuing to move with the Russians to eliminate enough plutonium for about 17,000 nuclear weapons, largely burning it in reactors for electricity, and that he said that when we're done, we'll cut American and Russian deployed nuclear weapons to their lowest levels since the 1950s. Of course, he's also dealing now with, I'm not sure whether Putin ever went away in terms of his relationship with Medvedev, but the long and the short of it is that Putin is nominally less flexible and perhaps even more hostile to the U.S., and they do have some problems over Syria. So do you think it's not just a question of after the elections? I think we're dealing with a different Russia now, aren't we?
It's a marginally different Russian. Putin has always been sort of a major figure behind the scenes. But it will be difficult. It has all along been difficult to take steps beyond the New START treaty. The Russians welcome, I think, further reductions, but they have problems with conventional forces as well. And we would, too, if we were in their position. They're highly exposed to sophisticated attack from conventional air, and they have very little reassurance in that regard. Now, I think it's likely that they will go along with further reductions because they, in fact, are probably intending to maintain a smaller arsenal anyway. Both sides have, despite all the reductions that have occurred, they have much more deterrent capability than is reasonably rational. It's still in excess. Both sides have plenty of room to reduce the size of their deployments and not have any diminishing effect on their deterrent capability at all.
But what about the incentive to save money on both sides? Surely there's some on our side.
There is some, but it's significant but not dominant. It's conventional forces that absorb most of the money, and that's where the biggest disparity in capability is. And as yet, reassurance to the Russians in that regard is not yet on the table, and will probably have to be put on the table if we're to get into truly meaningful extensions. You might get a reduction in the number of 1,000 is frequently mentioned, 1,500 down to 1,000. That can readily be done without changing anything in terms of deterrent capability. And the Russians probably are willing to go that low without anything else. Beyond that, bringing in the sort of the theater range systems on the Russian side, which we talk a lot about, is going to have a broader negotiation also dealing with conventional force issues. And we're not as yet prepared for that. At least there's been very little talk about that and very little indication that the government as a whole is prepared for that discussion.
So, John Steinbrenner, again, Professor of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, where he directs the Center for International and Security Studies and the Chairman of the Board of the Arms Control Association. You mentioned earlier in response to President Obama's speech at the Summit to Secure Nuclear Materials in Seoul, South Korea, where he spoke from the heart, that was welcome, and in contrast to his predecessors, it seems to me that even in our conversation, there's a difference between the arms control regimes of the past with the Soviet Union and the current, and the successor Russian regime are a whole different kettle of fish compared to the issues that are involved in non-proliferation and particularly in terms of Iran and North Korea. But it seems to me that the biggest damage that was ever done in terms of non-proliferation regimes is what George W. Bush did with Iraq, that he and his regime essentially lied us into a war based upon the threat of nuclear weapons, which turned out to be non-existent. And surely that sent a message to everybody around the world that you better get your nuclear weapons first because, you'll have some leverage. That's just my opinion. I don't mean to impose my opinion, but that's my opinion.
And it's a common thought. But when you get down to the realities of it, neither Iran nor North Korea are in any position to be protected rather than threatened by nuclear weapons in their possession. The North Koreans probably do understand that. They're playing a very weak hand, and they walked a very fine line, trying to bring about basically a deal whereby they are given security assurances, i.e. we will not try to overthrow you by force, we will tolerate your regime, and we will remove sanctions. That's what they're clearly after. It's reasonable supposition that that's what the Iranians are after, too. Despite all our proclamations about what we think they think they're doing, the reality of it is Iran, in particular, has very poor prospect of actually safely acquiring a nuclear weapon. They have not legitimized that. They've said that they're not trying to do it. They're turned around and said, "Oh well, we changed our mind, or we were lying about that. would be very dangerous to them. And you have to believe, and because there's a lot of diplomatic record there too, they also are trying to get an outcome whereby they are allowed enrichment capability, as they say, is a national sovereign right, which it is, but it's also a hedge that, you know, if you push us too hard, we really could do this, so don't drive us over the brink. And it's reasonable for them to stop at that point and to say, okay, we have a subliminal deterrent the way, say, the Japanese do, and lots of other countries as well that have highly enriched or plutonium-separated plutonium stocks. They're not displaying an active deterrent, but they're displaying the capacity to do it in reasonably short order if they're pushed too hard, and that's a reasonable outcome from their point of view. From ours as well. It keeps them short of a weapon. We do not want to have them a weapon. And that deal wants to be discussed and needs to be directly discussed, and it's not clear what's holding it up. I mean, the Iranians appear to be ready to talk about that, and the U.S. seems to be reluctant, and it's not clear why we would be reluctant to talk about that.
Well, but the talk that is going on is whether or not Israel will strike preemptively, whether they'll do it with or without U.S. permission. And there is a lot of speculation that in order for President Obama to dissuade Netanyahu from doing something before the elections, which would at the very least cause the price of gasoline to rise precipitously, that there may be some kind of agreement that something will be done after the elections. So at this point, it seems that we're talking mostly about the choice between preemptive strikes or diplomacy, and the preponderance of what we hear in the press from the pundits is that diplomacy doesn't work with North Korea and it doesn't work with Iran.
Yeah, and that is a completely inaccurate account of both the historical record in both cases. And it is a bit alarming. The U.S. press, quite frankly, as a whole, is behaving a little bit like they behaved in the run-up to Iraq, where they, you know, they took the bait and ran with it. Whereas anybody who really knew anything was listening to the IAEA knew that Iraq did not have nuclear weapons. That was really not a question. But it was presented as a question, and the U.S. claim that it did was presented as a credible statement in the American press running up to that thing. This is sort of vaguely reminiscent of it. The people who know about the situation know that Iran has proposed compromise arrangements which would keep them short of a nuclear weapon, reliably short of a nuclear weapon. And that is what diplomacy ought to be doing, is discussing that outcome, because it's the only good outcome, actually. But both sides are posturing, and yes, the Israelis are, particularly Netanyahu, is threatening this. The kindest thing you can say about it is that it's political theater, and he knows it. Beyond that, it is insanity, frankly, because that's the one way in which you would legitimize an Iranian nuclear program, is attack them. Then the rest of the world will say, okay, well, they're going to have to get it. You cannot deny it by the attack. You can postpone it for some extent, but you would almost certainly push them over the brink by legitimizing getting the weapon. That's the one thing that might do it. And it is wildly irresponsible. And frankly, anybody who knows anything about the real dynamics of this understands that that would be a disaster. Israel cannot do that. We cannot do that strategically. It's both morally and strategically indefensible. And yes, there are, you know, pundits arguing the contrary, but, you know, they really are extremists. There really is a consensus for people who know anything that an attack would be disastrous, and particularly given that the diplomatic formula is there to be grabbed. Many of us are very alarmed by the drumbeat of war. It is irrational, it is unrealistic, and yet you're right that that is the dominant theme as you read the American press.
Well, just in closing, John Steinbrenner, you've made a very strong case that Iran, that diplomacy, the diplomatic track is doable with Iran, and that they want a situation not unlike the situation that Japan has, where they have nuclear capability in terms of fuel, but have not moved towards a weapon. And I believe, you know, back in the 60s, the Swedes even went to that point and stepped back. Let's just, in the last minute there, turn it to North Korea. Back in 1994, President Clinton apparently was considering a preemptive strike to prevent North Koreans going nuclear. Jimmy Carter went over there on his own on an emergency mission, feeling that there was a that they were on a dangerous collision course. What's your assessment of the possibility of the same kind of diplomacy that the Iranians appear to be open to being exercised with North Korea?
Well, North Korea is already, the formula for North Korea has already been stated repeatedly, and we're still in this lengthy process of trying to implement it. The formula is they give up their entire program in a reasonably verifiable way, and we remove economic sanctions, and we basically give them assurances that we will not attack them if they don't attack us, of course. We will not initiate attack, i.e., we will not try to change your regime by force. That's the formula for North Korea. It's pretty clear all along that's what's been after, and that's what the six-party talks were all about, trying to bring that about. That's the outcome in North Korea. It's also the logical outcome in Iran.
So again, you think the hawks are dominating the debate?
Less so in North Korea than in Iran, but yeah, I mean, North Korea has no proponents, zero proponents in the United States. Nobody is willing to stand up and say, okay, they say flamboyant things, et cetera, but here's their point of view. Nobody is willing to do that. Mm-hmm. They can be blamed for that. They've done a lot to deserve that, but that isn't good diplomacy, is to demonize your opponent who is actually trying to come to accommodation. But as a result, in U.S. political dialogue, North Korean perspectives are legitimate perspectives are never presented. They're always presented as irrational, belligerent bargainers. And, you know, of course, they do a lot to sort of earn that image. However, the details, if you go look at the diplomatic details, throughout from 94 onward, it's pretty clear what they've been trying to do. They've been trying to turn in the nuclear program in exchange for international rehabilitation. It's the major card in their hand. They've been trying to play it. It's kind of a land peace formula. They're willing to give up the land. They can't get the peace. That's their problem.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, John Steinbrenner.
Okay, take care.
You too. Again, I was speaking with John Steinbrenner, who's a professor of public policy at the University of Maryland, where he directs the Center for International Security Studies. He has authored and edited a number of books, including The Cybernetic Theory of Decision, New Dimensions of Political Analysis, Principles of Global Security, and A New Concept of Cooperative Security. He co-chairs the Committee on International Security Studies of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and is chairman of the board of the Arms Control Association. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbons. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.